70 years ago this week, Japan's formal surrender on the deck of the USS Missouri brought an official end to World War II. But on the silver screen, the Great War has raged on ever since. Hollywood loves World War II. The gladiatorial optics, the moral clarity, the outright heroics. And this hour on Midday, we're going to explore that cinematic fascination. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dan Rodericks. Midday film critics Linda DeLibro and Christopher Llewellyn Reed join me for a decade-by-decade survey of critically acclaimed World War II movies. Sands of Iwo Jima, The Bridge on the River Kwai, Hell in the Pacific, Tora, 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 Empire of the Sun, Flags of Our Fathers, and many more. World War II on the silver screen, right after the news from NPR. From WYPR, this is Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dan Rodericks today. In this hour, we ask the question, why are we so obsessed with movies about World War II? The war ended 70 years ago this week, but the movies march heroically on year after year, decade after decade, and our appetite for these films never, ever seems to run out. I'm here in studio this hour with two folks who are primed and ready to help us figure out this long-standing cinematic fascination. Linda DeLibro is head of the Film and Media Studies program at the Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed is chair and professor in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. Linda and Chris, welcome to you both.
Great to be here, Aaron.
So happy to be here.
You guys ready?
Oh, so ready.
So ready as we're going to be.
It's an overwhelming topic, but yeah. We've done our homework.
Hollywood started making movies about World War II before the war even ended, and they've continued to crank them out pretty much constantly every year since, right up to the present day, and probably on into the future for cinematic eternity. Why? Why can't we get enough?
Well, I think it's the last big war with, in the popular imagination, clear good versus evil. I think most wars since then have been compromised. And there have been so many films that I just want to point out to the listening audience that because 2 days ago was the 70th anniversary of the Japanese surrender, Linda and I elected to focus exclusively on films of the Pacific Theater. Because otherwise,
it would get ridiculous.
This is a subgenre of the genre that is World War II movies.
That is correct.
Okay. Right. So you guys, Linda, let me have you sound off on this as well. You hear Chris saying this is our last great moral black and white moment in geopolitical history.
Oh, it's pretty much the first and last, because as we did a show in November on World War I, and that certainly wasn't a war with clear moral boundaries. It was a pointless war, so you actually had a lot of anti-war films coming out of it during and after the war, and then they quickly disappeared. But I think, you know, as we discuss these films coming up, we'll see how the war has in many ways been used as a political football since it ended in 1945. And certainly during the war, it was used for propaganda purposes. Films were a really important part of the war effort in Hollywood. But I think for the average viewer, it's a way to explore a whole host of moral dilemmas, particularly in the past 20 or 30 years when things do get a little bit more ambiguous, more complicated, and we have directors and filmmakers really exploring a whole panoply of issues through the lens of World War II.
I should say, listeners, you are most welcome to join this conversation this hour with your thoughts and your questions. Are you a fan of the World War II movie genre? Why? What do these movies mean to you? Give us a call at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email, the address midday@wypr.org. Chris and Linda, you guys always come well prepared for these visits. We've got a list of films here from 1943 all the way up to the present. We're going to sort of start at the chronological beginning of this list and make our way to the present over the course of this discussion this hour. So we're going to start with this 1943 film titled So Proudly We Hail. And Chris, we've got a clip here from the movie. You want to sort of give us a little context before we hear this?
Absolutely. So this was a film I actually had never seen before prepping for this show. It's directed by Mark Sandrich, who, amazingly, given how brutal a war film this is, had earlier made 4 of the 9 Fred Astaire, Ginger Roger musicals, including Top Hat.
So this is a departure for him.
This is indeed. And this is made during the war, 1943, shortly after the American evacuation of the Philippines. So at a sort of a low point, potentially, of American morale during the war. And it's set in the Philippines and tells a story of a group of nurses played by Claudette Colbert, Paulette Goddard of earlier Charlie Chaplin film fames, and Veronica Lake, among others. And they're, striving to do their best and dealing with what happens when the hospitals at which they work are overrun by advancing Japanese troops. And people die. People become demoralized in the film. And it's just an amazingly direct view of the toils of war. And in the clip that we chose, it's towards the end of the film, and Claudette Colbert, who's the head nurse at this point, or one of the head nurses, maybe not the top one, is finally broken down by all of the events that have gone on, and kind of in almost a direct pitch to the American people, with a cynical edge, she sort of explains what her feelings are at this point about the future of the war effort. And remember, this is right after the Americans are being forced to evacuate from the Philippines.
There's no quinine left.
Well, what are we going to do?
Nurse, what do you think we're going to do?
They can take us off. Why are we here anyway?
Why? Why isn't there any quinine? Why isn't there any food? Why aren't there any supplies?
Why are we waiting here like rats in a cage, waiting for the man to come and pour scalding water over us?
Why was nothing done?
Why?
Take it easy, Dave.
I'll tell you why. It's our own fault.
Our fault? What did we do?
Because we believed we were the world, that the United States of America was the whole world. Those outlandish places, Bataan, Corregidor, Mindanao, those aren't American names. No, they're just American graveyards.
Well, why don't they get us off?
They can't get us off. We've become what they call a delaying action. That's what those 50,000 men over there were. They were merely saving time. I hope to God the people back home aren't losing it for us.
Wow. So Proudly We Hail, a 1943 American movie. Linda DeLibro, you saw this movie in preparation for this show. You just heard that clip. I mean, what speaks to you about this film?
Well, I had seen it quite a long time ago, and it really stuck in my mind. Among those films that were made during the war, I too was struck by the brutal frankness of the violence in the film, particularly because it deals with women in the war effort. And so you do see these women under extremely harsh circumstances. And it's one of those, it's one of many films that were made during the war about the Pacific Theater, not nearly as many films at the time were made about the war in Europe, because Americans pretty much understood what was going on there. They had been attuned to, the Britain's struggles, and certainly knew about Hitler and the Italians. But when Pearl Harbor was attacked, many people, as Claudette Colbert's character says in this clip, didn't really know what was going on in the Pacific. They didn't know that much about the Japanese. They knew they were fighting a war in China and that it was supposed to be bad, but they were not familiar with these foreign names. They didn't understand the campaign. They didn't have much access to information about it. I think to this day, most of us don't think about the fact that we surrendered the Philippines in the middle of this war, and that was the result of that. One of the many results was the Bataan Death March, which people never found out about until later. So these war films about the Pacific were specifically addressed to a public that was hungering for some kind of narrative, some kind of explanation. And this film in particular, I think, gives us this very raw depiction of the horrors of what was going on in the Philippines from a female perspective, and by women who are really calling out the U.S. for its isolationism and to, you know, get on the stick and get them, you know, get things going, get them out of there, showing the dire need to fuel the war effort.
How interesting that, you know, that of this entire list of films, the first one we hear and the earliest in this series is really the sort of the most and perhaps only kind of feminist World War II movie.
Yes, although there are films, particularly adaptations of Neville Shute's novel, A Town Like Alice, of which there have been at various points in the 60s and then in the 80s adaptations. And those deal with, you know, women in the camps, because there are a number of films that deal. Paradise Road with Glenn Close is another film that deals with women in the camps. So I would say it's certainly the really one of the few at this time. But there have been later films that have dealt with war from a woman's perspective.
Right. You've got more you want to say about this one? Okay,
well,
then we'll
move on.
Go ahead.
I think this gives a human voice. This is a very personal story. And, of course, there's this dilemma about women going to war or aiding the war effort. And how do we switch gears from being wives and mothers, and that's our understanding at the time of what women do, and now all of a sudden everybody has to face the fact that they're doing all these extraordinary things that are men's work. So this film is very conflicted about that. It focuses a lot about the female romances, but in terms of the time, I think it's this call to arms through the voice of the people who are most apt to be watching these kinds of movies.
Very true. And in fact, in terms of its conflicted nature of its view of women at war, one of the female characters ends up inadvertently getting people killed because she runs back to grab her negligee. So that gives you a sense of
sure.
Of the film.
It is a product of its time.
It is a product of its time, yes.
All right. All right. We got a lot of these we want to get through. The title of that first one, again, that we were just talking about, So Proudly We Hail, a 1943 film directed by Mark Sandrich. Next up here on Midday on Film, a 1945 movie. By John Ford, They Were Expendable. This is a John Wayne movie.
It is, although the clip I've chosen doesn't feature John Wayne, but the next movie we'll talk about does. So
he's
have
in
no
two
fear.
Of these.
Yes,
okay,
have no fear. Oh,
John Wayne was in many
a World War II film and many a Pacific Theater film. Even though he never really served in the war, and John Ford would make fun of him about that fact on set.
Okay.
So the great John Ford, best known for Westerns, made this film right at the end of the war. So they're shooting it before the actual end of the war. It comes out in 45. And it also takes place in the Philippines, where Robert Montgomery and John Wayne are PT boat captains, or I forget their ranks, but they sail PT boats, patrol torpedo boats, and they have a plan where their small rapid boats might be more effective against the Japanese fleet in the Philippines than the larger boats. So they're put to work. Some of their missions succeed, some don't, but of course, history in this movie is against them because we did surrender the Philippines. And in this moment, you'll hear the voice on the radio announcing to our dejected protagonists the very fact of the surrender.
WBKR, San Francisco. A brief interruption, please. This is spot and tragic news from the Philippines. The white flag of surrender was hoisted on the bloody heights of Bataan this afternoon. 36,000 United States soldiers, hungry, ragged, half-starved shadows, trapped like rats but dying like men, were finally worn down by 200,000 picked Japanese troops. Men who fight for an unshakable faith are more than flesh, but they're not steel. Flesh must yield at last. Endurance melts away. The end must come. Bataan has fallen. But the spirit that made it stand as a beacon to all lovers of liberty will never falter. The white flag was hardly hoisted over Bataan before Jap artillery began slamming away at Corregidor, our last strong point in the Philippines.
A clip there from the film They Were Expendable, 1945. You're tuned to Midday here on WYPR, Aaron Henkin in studio with Midday film critics Linda DeLibro and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. We're talking about World War II on the silver screen. We'll get to some commentary about that film right after the break. You're welcome to join the conversation, listeners, with your thoughts and questions. Are you a fan? of these movies? What makes you love these movies and why? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send an email, midday@wypr.org. We'll get to your calls, your thoughts, your questions right after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday on Film. Aaron Henkin here, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. I'm joined by Midday film critics Linda DeLibro, head of the Film and Media Studies Program at the Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair and professor in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. Right before the break, guys, on this survey of World War II movies, we heard a clip from the 1945 film They Were Expendable. Linda DeLibro, I'm going to turn it over to you. What do you want to say about this film?
It's really interesting because Ford wanted to make it during the war. He didn't get it made until after the Philippines had been re-won. So it was kind of superfluous, but it really is quite a good film. And it's a very Fordian film in that it certainly carries on the themes of his great Westerns in the sense of depicting this amazing world of male camaraderie and the absolute necessity of self-sacrifice for the greater cause. So it has these really interesting elements, and it's also a nice companion piece to So Proudly We Hail, because we chose these two clips because they echoed each other in the sense of, you know, these people being trapped like rats, surrendering the horror of that and the need for America to overcome its reservations about the war and really fight, except that in 1945 it was already a done deal.
Listeners, I guarantee and promise you we're going to get to your calls, you calling in, and be patient. But first, I know we want to make a direct transition from the movie we just checked out, They Were Expendable, to this next film, 1949, Sands of Iwo Jima. Chris, set this one up for us.
Okay, so this is directed by Alan Dwan, and it stars John Wayne again. This is the first time we'll hear him. And this is the film for which he received his first Oscar nomination. His second was for True Grit in 1969, and he won for that film. And the clip I've chosen is early in the movie, where John Wayne, playing Sergeant Stryker, comes in, and he's sort of training his men for battle in the Pacific. Now, this is 4 years after the war was over, and, you know, attitudes towards the war in film have now become, you know, very patriotic, none of the cynicism we sort of heard in those first two films, although later on, you know, the films will become more nuanced. But at this point, it's sort of always a triumphalist aesthetic in the films. And so here you have John Wayne explaining to his men, a Sergeant Stryker, how he is going to train them to be Marines.
My name is Stryker, Sergeant John M. Stryker. You're going to be my squad, a rifle squad. Three of us have seen action. Corporal Dunn, Charlie Bass, and myself. You're going to learn from us. In boot camp, you learned out of a book. Out here, you got to remember the book and learn 1,000 things that have never been printed, probably never will be. You got to learn right, and you got to learn fast. And any man that doesn't want to cooperate, I'll make him wish he hadn't been born. Before I'm through with you, you're going to move like one man and think like one man. If you don't, you'll be dead. You guys have had a nice, easy day. I hope you enjoyed it, because it's the last one you're going to get for a long time. You joined the Marines because you wanted to fight. Well, you're going to get your chance. And I'm here to see that you know how. And if I can't teach you one way, I'll teach you another. But I'm going to get the job done.
The inimitable voice of John Wayne in that 1949 film, Sands of Iwo Jima. Linda DeLibro, your thoughts on this film?
Yes, this is really interesting because here we do see the war being used for political purposes. By this time, the Cold War is in full force, and Hollywood is at pains to demonstrate its patriotism. And what better figure to do that than John Wayne, who in this film really defines the role of the battalion, the sergeant, the tough boot camp guy who permeates the scene. And it really becomes this kind of mythic portrayal. But it also is a film that is very much about proving the patriotism of the people who made it. Hollywood really is under the gun at this point, and that becomes this kind of it's when the war becomes much more about the myth of World War II than about the actual reality of the war.
Yes, I agree. Hollywood is in the middle of its ongoing blacklist and starting to have, you know, force people to name names, which would consume it for much of the next decade. So, yes, I agree with Linda that this is very much about proving one's jingoistic credentials.
It's really interesting to think about these movies as essentially becoming the most, you know, the latest in a string of, you know, sort of the official version in our collective memory of what the war must have been like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll take a quick turn to the phones here. We've got a caller, I think, who's probably got some thoughts on just that subject. We're going to go first to Steve in Cockeysville. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Hi there. My dad is a veteran of World War II, and I'm a veteran as well. And I grew up with stories of his derring do in aerial combat in Europe, and it had a profound effect on me. The notion being this, it was a heroic, epic challenge in that all real men should rise to this. And Hollywood didn't help that myth any with their portrayal of war. And then comes along Vietnam and then my experience in the service, and I think Hollywood did us a disservice. You know, there's this sense that war is a great thing and everybody should try it because it's really important. And then along comes Saving Private Ryan, and suddenly you realize 19-year-old kids die screaming for their mother with their guts hanging out. And that is a more accurate portrayal of war and eliminates the myth. And I guess that's my point. Hollywood perpetuated a vile myth about the heroism.
Steve, thanks for your call, for your insight. I'll let our film critics respond.
I just want to say that Hollywood is guilty of myth-making, really, in all subjects. This is sort of what the film industry does. And what's interesting is that the first film we played, I think, is very much about the horrors of war. And Hollywood at various times has sort of overcome its tendencies towards mythologizing the glories of war. But overall, certainly in terms of World War II films, most of what we've seen since the 40s have been films that have extolled the virtues of military service without the guts hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because a film like Born on the 4th of July, the Oliver Stone film about Ron Kovic, the real-life anti-war protester who was a vet and lost his legs
Vietnam.
In Vietnam.
Right.
And in the book and in the film, he very specifically addresses Sergeant Stryker and the fact that the reason these boys were so eager to sign up for Vietnam was because of these Hollywood films that they had grown up with and about the myth of invincibility, the disguise of the horrors of war in favor of this jingoistic kind of attitude.
And films about the Vietnam War have certainly been a powerful corrective, I think, to this idea of war as purely glorious.
There certainly aren't as many of them as there are World War II movies, though, are there?
There aren't as many, but those that are and those that people see tend to be about the horrors of war.
Yeah. Midday on Film this Friday here on the radio. Aaron Henkin in studio with Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro. We're talking about World War II movies specifically the subgenre of the genre, Pacific Theater, World War II movies. Next up, the iconic Bridge on the River Kwai. Chris?
Yeah, so this is from David Lean, 1957. This is really the beginning of his, widescreen epic period. Later he would make Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, and become the master of the widescreen. So the film stars William Holden, Alec Guinness, Oscar-nominated Japanese actor Sesue Hayakawa as the Japanese camp commander. He'd actually been a movie star in the silent period in the United States, had a long career, and then had gone back to Japan and then came back for this, and Jack Hawkins. And it's the first sort of the films we've listened to so far, it's the first sort of truly anti-war film, sort of taking a look at the madness of war and what it drives human beings to do. So we have a group of
British soldiers who are captured by the Japanese, and we meet them as they walk into the camp whistling the tune that we've been hearing during the breaks.
It'll be in your head the rest of the day.
Right away they find out that the Japanese, who were known for the brutal camp conditions that they created, are going to put everybody to work, including the officers, which technically goes against the Geneva Convention. So Colonel Nicholson, played by Alec Guinness, insists on a point of law that this not happen, and ends up, because he's more stubborn than the Japanese, and because the Japanese are unable to build this bridge over the River Kwai that they'd like to, he's able to convince them to see things his way, and the British soldiers end up building this bridge. And it ends up being about the madness of many things, war, insistence on points of law. And in this clip, we hear Nicholson, Alec Guinness, talking to his officers and the American officer in the room, William Holden, about what he sees as the dilemma that the British soldiers are about to face.
Oh, I'd say the odds against a successful escape are about 100-1.
Right.
But may I add another word, Colonel?
Please.
The odds against survival in this camp are even worse. You've seen the graveyard. They're your real odds. To give up hope of escape, to even stop thinking about it, is like accepting a death sentence.
Why haven't you tried to escape, Commander?
Oh, I've been biding my time, waiting for the right moment, the right company.
I understand how you feel. Of course, it's normally the duty of a captured soldier to attempt escape. But my men and I are involved in a curious legal point of which you are unaware. In Singapore, we were ordered to surrender by command headquarters. Ordered, mind you. Therefore, in our case, escape might well be an infraction of military law. Interesting.
Yes, sir. Interesting point. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't quite follow you. You mean you intend to uphold the letter of the law, no matter what it costs?
Without law, Commander, there is no civilization.
That's just my point. Here, there is no civilization.
Then we have the opportunity to introduce it.
From the 1957 film The Bridge on the River Kwai. Linda DeLibro, your thoughts, reactions to this film?
Yes, I know this film fairly well, and I know that the central dilemma here is, how far do you go? It's the irrationality of the rational. And it's also a pretty pointed critique of the British class system, of the absolute absurdity of the hierarchy, the military hierarchy, the idea of honor carried to extremes. But it's also one of the first films that really explores this idea of the differences between the Pacific War and the European War in its use of setting. You have the jungle setting, you have all of the Pacific films are really closely tied to this idea of nature as being ruthless, as being associated with the brutality and ruthlessness of the Japanese, who are the other in a very different way from the way the Nazis are portrayed. They are somehow subhuman, or their sense of brutality, of what's necessary to win the war, puts them into an entirely different category from the human. And so you have these two themes playing throughout this film in really interesting ways, so that you see that what this Alec Guinness character is really dealing with is the mirror of his own absurdity in the Japanese commander. And it both humanizes that commander and dehumanizes him at the same time. I think it's a really interesting film.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. The great British novelist Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote The Remains of the Day, and is Japanese by ethnicity and culture, but raised in England, said that only a Japanese writer could have really understood the mindset of a British butler. So that there's a certain kind of inverse, as Linda's talking about, a mirror imaging in terms of the cultural specificities of the Japanese and the British, which I find fascinating in that film. And it is true, the Japanese were, no more, but at least as brutal as the Nazis, but frequently they are portrayed as much more alien because they belong to a, quote, other race than the Nazis. And they certainly were very brutal in their occupation, but no more so than the Nazis.
410-662-8780, the number to call to Bring your voice to this conversation about World War II movies, movies about the Pacific Theater in World War II. And we'll head back to the phones now and hear from Phil in Hamden. Phil, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yes. Have any of you seen the 1977 film MacArthur starring Gregory Peck?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was, I think it was in 1977. Gregory Peck starred as MacArthur.
Our critics are nodding their head. Yep, they know that one.
Yes. I like that movie very much. And also, of course, as you mentioned, The Bridge in the River Kwai. And also, even though it was the European part of the war, Saving Private Ryan was excellent.
Phil, what draws you to these movies? I mean, why do you like to watch them?
Well, I've always been interested in World War II history very much. It just fascinates me. It's one of my major interests.
Yeah.
And, and of course, even like what Schindler's List was a very different type of film. It was about, the horror, the concentration camps. And, but there are so many about the battles too. And in any event, it's just a fascinating subject to me. And I think it's important to appreciate what, the Allies did. It would be a very different world now if the Germans and Japanese had won the war.
Well, Phil, I want to thank you for your interest in the subject and for giving us a call today. Our guests have spoken a bit about Saving Private Ryan. You mentioned MacArthur as well. Let's go one more time to the phones here and hear from John in Baltimore. John, you're on the air on Midday.
Hello, I just wanted to say something about John Ford.
Sure.
He was an officer in naval intelligence before and during the war. He served in Burma. And when he made the film's documentaries, Pearl Harbor and The Battle of Midway, there was a naval officer that was assigned to work with him who participated in both battles. And Ford said, after the war, come look me up. He did. And this guy was in all the John Ford cavalry films and in Red River. He played, I think his name was Cunningham, he played the Irish cowboy with the bowler hat in Red River and one of the sergeants in the cavalry trilogy. And I just wanted to mention that.
Great, thank you. And I just want to point out, although you didn't say that Red River was directed by John Ford, but for those listening, Red River is actually directed by Howard Hawks.
Oh.
But the other films, the Cavalry Trilogy, is John Ford. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. But that guy, he was in all those films, and he did play that part.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
So, John in Baltimore, thank you for your thoughts. Obviously, many folks out there who are very avid, historians of this film genre. I mean, this is a fascinating subject. We're going to continue to talk about this after the break. Let me just say that I'm going to give you the phone number one more time, folks, if you're interested in joining the conversation, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email, the address midday@wypr.org. Midday on Film will continue right after the break. We're continuing to march on here. Welcome back to Midday on Film. I'm Aaron Henkin in for Dan Rodericks here in studio this hour with the Midday film duo, Linda DeLibro. She's head of the Film and Media Studies program at Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair and professor in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. This hour, we're exploring our ongoing fascination with World War II on the silver screen, and next up, we're going to talk about Empire of the Sun.
That's right. So there are some other films that were on our list that we won't have time to talk about that I just want to mention. Hell in the Pacific from 1968 by John Borman, which has Lee Marvin and the Japanese actor Toshiro Mifune stranded on an island in the Pacific, and they have to learn to work together. Fascinating movie. Tora, Tora, Tora from 1970 was a co-directed film by American and Japanese directors about the lead-up to Pearl Harbor. It's not everybody's favorite, but it's an interesting procedural, basically, about how the attack happened from various points of view. And then there are a bunch of Japanese films. Linda had mentioned to me Black Rain and The Burmese Harp.
so that deal with the Japanese perspective on the war, and Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence from 1983 by Negisa Oshima. Which brings us up to 1987 and Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun, starring a very young Christian Bale, and who ends up in one of the Japanese camps. He's a child of basically taipans, right? Very wealthy Western businessmen.
He's like a 10 or 11-year-old boy.
He's like a 10 or 11-year-old boy who gets separated from his family when the Japanese invade Shanghai. And ends up in a camp where he becomes sort of the sidekick of the Americans in the camp. He's a British boy. And this is a moment when the lead American in the camp, John Malkovich, played by John Malkovich, and he are talking about kind of how the war is going for the Americans.
I've never seen that one before. What year is it?
45.
45? How'd you get that?
I subscribed. Got Packard, Studebaker, Jell-O, you know, things from home. Can you get me a sewing needle?
I'll try. What's that?
It's a trap.
What are you snitching? Get out of here. It's all right, Jim. You're almost one of us. Did you see that Mustang yesterday?
It's the Cadillac of the sky, basically.
That's right. Be plenty soon. B-29s, too.
B-29s?
Yep. The Super Fortress, what we call a hemisphere defense weapon.
Where from?
Okinawa, Philippines. Tokyo is in bombing range now.
Tokyo?
Good time to think of going home soon.
We'll have to leave the camp.
That's the idea, Jim. First one side feeds you and the other side tries to get you killed and then it's turned around. It's all timing.
Will you tell me when it's time?
Sure.
Promise?
Promise.
John Malkovich, the American voice there, talking to a very young Christian Bale in the 1987 film Empire of the Sun. Linda DeLibro. Your thoughts, your opinion about this movie?
Yeah, you know, I had somehow managed never to see it until this point. Hmm. And I was actually very surprised because I know some people really hated it when it came out. It didn't do very well at the box office.
Chris is raising
Chris
his
is
hand.
One of
when,
them.
It, when it first came fan, out, huh? I've become a fan since
okay.
then.
And it, I can see why it didn't do well because I think it's probably Spielberg's most mature and deeply disturbing film. And I ended up really admiring it quite a bit. I thought it was absolutely the most unsentimental portrayal of a child coming of age that I've possibly ever seen. And part of what I realized was, you know, Christian Bale is extraordinary in the film. And you never really love this kid because he is so – it's really a study of moral blindness. It's about the imaginative – the dangers of the imagination in turning things that are dangerous, his worship of the Japanese pilots, his worship of the pomp of – the war, the military, the planes, and his absolute denial of the reality of his situation. You know, he doesn't want to leave the camp because this is his home and he's created a life around it. Of course, he's in terrible circumstances. He's lost his parents. He doesn't know where they are. He's in this brutal camp and he's quite young. But he manages to survive by basically sustaining illusions about what's really going on, and he sustains them past the point of really sanity. And the film never really backs off of that perspective, and the boy comes of age and becomes deeply disillusioned, and the film does not end very happily, even though he is united with his parents. It suggests that what he's been through and the things he's denied that he has finally had to come to grips with have irrevocably changed him. And it is a very disturbing portrait of childhood.
That's right. He's forever scarred by his experiences in the war. It's a film that, though it's set in a Japanese camp, unlike some Japanese internment camp films, it does give the Japanese characters some level of humanity, and there's even a friendship at one point between the Christian Bale character and a young Japanese kid. So,
analysis there of the film Empire of the Sun, 1987, Steven Spielberg. Our survey of World War II films continues here on Midday on Film. We're going to talk next about the film, 1998 film, The Thin Red Line.
That's right. Directed by Terrence Malick, he who for a long time was extremely unprolific. In fact, this was only his third feature film. He had done in the 70s Badlands, and then in the late 70s, early 80s, Days of Heaven, and then finally he returned to directing with 1998's The Thin Red Line. This is the second adaptation of it's Jim Jones, right? That's the name of the author, Linda?
Mm-hmm.
Of James Jones's novel. He also wrote From Here to Eternity. There had been an adaptation of this book in the 60s as well. And it's a film, again, about the madness of military conflict, in particular, like so many war or anti-war films about sort of a disconnect between the upper levels of military hierarchy and the lower levels of the soldiers, the grunt soldiers on the ground. And in this scene, we hear Nick Nolte, who's the commander who's been leading forces from afar as they try to take control of Guadalcanal. This is about the Battle of Guadalcanal, talking to John Cusack, who's a lower officer who's actually been in combat and led his men to take this first hill, and we'll hear sort of this amazing disconnect, this irreality, this lack of understanding of what the men are going through from Nick Nolte.
Now, we better get moving out of here. We need to extend our lines, hook up with the other companies, and push on to the top. Would you like to take command of Baker Company over on the left?
Of course. Sir, I don't mean to be a wet blanket or anything like that, but about the water, if we don't get some water to...
Don't worry about water.
John, I don't want anything to break up this attack of ours now that we have the momentum. We'll have some water in a couple of hours. I've arranged for that. Now we just can't stop now, goddammit, and wait for it.
No, sir.
That's right. And if some of the men pass out, why the hell, they'll just have to pass out.
All right. They could, you know, they could die from it.
Well, they could die from enemy fire, too. They're all tough boys. Come on, man, let's go. You'll see plenty more of those where we're going. Are we going up this hill, aren't we?
1998, The Thin Red Line. This movie, this was kind of the definitive World War II movie for me. I mean, that's the one the first one that really kind of sunk in and hit me and kind of really painted my mental picture of the war. And this movie was, you know, the director Terrence Malick, sort of a quirky character. I've read a little bit about the backstory of the production of this film. I mean, it's got a huge ensemble cast. It ended up being like 6, 8, 10 hours long, the original cut. They had to cut most of the people out of it. I mean, what this thing seems like it was kind of a mess to make, but it ended up being quite a masterpiece, huh?
Yes, well, I would say it is a masterpiece and definitely my favorite by far on this list. And the film had the misfortune of opening nearly simultaneously with Saving Private Ryan, which for all of its greatness and glory is certainly a conventional war film, which Thin Red Line is most definitely not. So it was treated pretty brutally by the critics when it came out. Since then, it has gained in stature. I think many people believe it to be a masterpiece. And I think the trouble, and I put that in quotation marks with it, was that Malick's films do not follow a conventional narrative. Everything that you think about war films and what they're supposed to be and the expectations that they raise, he will thwart them at every turn. It's really about coming to grips with a sense of mortality in a way that is so deeply felt by the audience because of the way he makes his films, that you are forced to contemplate some of the most pressing questions about who we are, why we go to war, what it means to accept or deny the otherness of your enemy as a way of approaching transcendence. And so it's asking these very difficult questions through the voiceovers of many of these young soldier characters.
I've heard people say that, you know, while other World War II movies, you know, try to master the historical truth of the movie of the war, that Thin Red Line really comes the closest to mastering the emotional truth of the film.
I think that's a good way to describe Malick's intentions and what the film ultimately succeeds in doing.
You're tuned to Midday on Film. Linda DeLibro and Christopher Llewellyn Reed in studio with us. You can join the conversation at 410-662-8780. We'll go to the phones now and hear from Bruce in Timonium. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi. Have nothing profound to say about the movies, but I do want to tell you that I was 8 years old and remember the Pearl Harbor attack, and every movie we went to from then on seemed to be about the war. And so now it's just a nostalgic thing. When I see a movie about World War II, I go to it because it's something that I kind of experienced as a child. And I remember particularly when I was about 9 or 10, I was really very, very disturbed by the war and just wondered, is it ever going to end? And I wondered how that was going to turn out at that point. But the movies just mean a lot to me for that reason.
Thank you for your thoughts, Bruce.
Well, it's interesting because we do have a clip from a film that talks about sort of the way films and both still images and moving images were used to, you know, manufacture public participation in the war effort. You know, Clint Eastwood in 2006 made Flags of Our Fathers, which is not the greatest of his films, but he also made that same year Letters from Iwo Jima, which is a better film talking about the war from the Japanese perspective. But in Flags of Our Fathers, we sort of come full circle from some of what we've started with in the sense of trying to get the public enamored of the war effort. And in this scene, we have John Slattery kind of telling these three young men who were part of the Iwo Jima attack why they need to help raise money for the war.
You know what they're calling this bond drive? The Mighty Seventh. They might have called it that we're flat and broke and can't even afford bullets, so we're begging for your pennies, bond drive, but it didn't have quite the ring. They could have called it that, though, because the last four bond drives came up so short we just printed money instead. Ask any smart boy on Wall Street. He'll tell you our dollar's next to worthless. We borrowed so much, and nobody is lending any more. Ships aren't being built. Tanks aren't being built. Machine guns, bazookas, hand grenades, zip. You think this is a farce? You want to go back to your buddies? Well, stuff some rocks in your pockets before you get in the plane, because that's all we got left to throw at the Japanese. And don't be surprised if your plane doesn't make it off the runway, because the fuel dumps are empty. And our good friends the Arabs are only taking bullion. If we don't raise $14 billion, and that's million with a B, this war's over by the end of the month. We make a deal with the Japanese, we give whatever they want, and we come home, because you've seen them fight, and they sure ain't giving up.
2006, Clint Eastwood film, Flags of Our Fathers. We've only got about like 2 minutes left in the show, so that's pretty much going to be the last word. But Linda, let me just give you some final, an opportunity to do some final analysis, maybe of that film and the genre at large.
Yes, I think this continues to fascinate us. I mean, how can we not be called to ponder what the war meant? It casts a shadow over everything. It's part of our cultural memory. And these films, books, television shows over the years have sort of ossified a myth about the good war, the greatest generation. And very few of any of these things have really come to grips with what how horrifying this war was. And I think that is partly what we seek, a kind of knowledge, a new knowledge about it that we don't know. And I think to this day, it's really hard for us, particularly, to come to grips with the brutalities of the Pacific Theater, which, you know, atrocities were committed on both sides by our soldiers and the Japanese soldiers. These kinds of things we still don't really speak about. The vets themselves, you know, it's only very recently that we've become had a little bit of understanding about what they went through. And I think it's going to be a long time before we actually do unearth all the truths about the war and let it all come to light.
Linda, you're going to have the last word. That's going to wrap things up for this edition of Midday on Film. I want to say thanks very much to both of our Midday film critics, Linda DeLibro, head of the Film and Media Studies Program at the Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair and professor in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. Linda, Chris, thank you both for a great program.
Thanks for having us on, Aaron.
And I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning into the conversation. Dan will be back with you on Tuesday. And in the meantime, have a great weekend, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.